We're back. You're listening to Money Talks. I'm Troy Harmon here with Casey Smith and Jarrett McKenzie. We got a few more questions that we can answer. Again, if you guys have questions about your finances, the economy, any of those things, financial planning, business valuation, estate planning, any of that, you can always give us a call, 770-429-9166, or you can get us on Hensler.com, H-E-N-S-S-L-E-R. All right, so we do have a question this week from our good friend Bill Murray, who says, consider the following fictitious statement. I love it when they start like that. Economists expect 2017 growth to come in at 2%. He says, what is the definition of growth? Does growth equal percentage increase in GDP? How much growth is healthy? How little growth is bad? How is growth calculated? If growth is 2%, why does the stock market tend to grow at 10%? And is 10% for the stock market sustainable if growth is only 2%? What is the relationship between growth and the stock market indices? So a mouthful of questions, right? Yeah,
that's a lot to cover there.
Let's start from the top. What is the definition of growth? Obviously, when we talk about growth, economic growth, it's measured by gross domestic product. So it's the amount of goods and services that are created mm-hmm. within our economy. And usually we measure that by real GDP. So it's not just the nominal. We take, through a PCE deflator, we take out the inflation so we can measure what we produced last year at last year's prices versus what we produced this year at last year's prices. Yeah. So we take the inflation piece out of that.
Comparing apples to apples.
True.
Exactly,
growth.
Yeah. So, you know, inflation is one of the big things that that we fight. And as we get into there, does growth equal percent increase in GDP? Yes, absolutely. It's the annualized percentage rate increase in the gross domestic product. Over a quarter's time, we always measure it relative to the previous year's same quarter. So so we get an annualized number. How much growth is healthy? Well, I guess the real answer to that, we want as much growth as we can get without pushing inflation too much.
Yeah.
The Federal Reserve generally tends to have a target growth rate of 2%. They also have that target inflation rate of about 2%.
It's interesting how they came up with the target inflation rate. From what I understand, it was kind of just, more or less a round number. But it relates to the sort of the average rate of growth and what they kind of expect. And this is always a concept that was a little bit difficult for me, I guess, in economics courses and whatever else is that is inflation. You want some inflation, but not too much.
Right.
And you want some growth, but not too much. Not enough to increase inflation to where it's too much. And it's just, it's sort of counterintuitive because you think growth is good. Well, it is up to a point, all things in moderation.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't want growth that obviously drives the inflation beyond where someone can manage it and control it.
Right.
Yeah, so that healthy level is all relative, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, I guess I would go with, we've seen inflation or inflation around 2% is probably the biggest thing they focus on. Mm-hmm. But GDP at 3.5% generally doesn't cause too much inflation. So, we talk a lot about inflation. One of the numbers we talked about today is employment situation and the 4.6% unemployment.
Yep.
That generally tends to be where it starts quite often. Is we get full employment and then the wage inflation starts creeping in.
Takes all the slack out of the economy, to use an economics term. But you're going to see some tightening up, you would expect. When you see tightening in the labor markets, you should start to see prices go up because wages more than likely are going to go up because of supply and demand.
Right. Yeah. So how's growth calculated? Well, you take this year's GDP minus the inflation adjusted for a PCE deflator, and you basically subtract it from last year's, and then you divide that number by last year's GDP. The way you would calculate, pretty much any growth, including the growth in your portfolio.
Right.
If growth is 2%, why does the stock market tend to grow at 10%? Well, this is a long answer, and it's probably best that I use a little bit of a calculation, and hopefully you don't get lost, but it is somewhat long. So if
set your podcast to half speed.
Yeah. If GDP is 2%,
yeah,
and we know that our revenue is actually impacted by that inflation, so GDP is the real rate of growth in the economy, so 2% real rate, mm-hmm, plus the inflation that we've already adjusted out. Say it's 2%. We got 4% now, right?
Yep.
Revenue then would, you could argue, grow at about 4%. Well, because of the way companies work, you know, earnings are what the market trades on. Earnings are a percentage, a small, much smaller portion of your revenue, because you have costs within a company.
Right.
The more efficient a company gets, obviously, the more the earnings can grow with the same amount of revenue growth. Right. So assume you've got revenue growing at 4%, but your earnings might be growing at 5%. So we've already stepped above what you would see in GDP growth with just the revenue and earnings. We all know that PE can change, and it often does. Say the PE stepped up by 0.5%. You do a little math, and you wind up with if you have 5% earnings growth and a little bit of boost from your PE expanding. So the argument is, say we had a company that had $1 of earnings and a price-to-earnings ratio at 10, their price is going to be 10, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have 5% growth and still leave that 10, you have a 5% expansion in the price of the stock itself. Then you assume that about half of your earnings, in many companies, that's a pretty common amount, is paid out in dividend.
Mm-hmm.
So you do all the math, you get about 5.5% growth from just raw earnings. You get a little bit of expansion from an increase in the PE ratio, you get the dividends paid out. And if you're paying out half your dividends, I said we started with a company that had $1 worth of earnings per share. That's 50 cents,
right,
which is, mm-hmm, also, you know, I said $10 on the start.
Right.
We're already at about 10%.
Yeah.
Well, so, Bill, I mean, I would say this too, that, you know, look, there's a lot that goes into the stocks and the trading and what happens in the market. I mean, a lot of companies trade at a premium. That's not their true valuation. Whereas, you know, GDP is looked at as, like we were talking about, that real GDP. That's a real tangible number that is calculated based on the goods and services that,
right,
we consumed as an economy. Whereas, I mean, even from a speculation standpoint, you can drive up through supply and demand the price of a stock. And so what you're seeing in the market, that might be true growth, but it does not necessarily represent the growth of those companies that are probably going to be more closely reflected with what's happening in the GDP.
Well, right, when you think about how a stock or any security for that matter is priced, it's, I mean, it comes down to the present value of the future cash flows. Right?
Absolutely.
So what they, you know, what people who are a lot smarter than me do is go out and try to project and forecast what the future cash flows are going to be into perpetuity, try to discount that back to the present, and that's what you end up with your stock price. So,
right,
you know, while those are all, you know, really good explanations, it's a company's, to Jared's point, that's not going to trade at its book value necessarily, what the company would be worth, you know, and if you were to just sell off all the assets. It's going to be based on the revenues that they're expected to produce, which is tied back to GDP and inflation and all those things that Troy mentioned. So,
right,
it's not a very simple explanation. But you know,
did you say people smarter than you? I mean, you're the smartest guy I know, man.
Well,
where are these people?
I'm trying to
get to talk to
you, you know.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure, because, yeah, if they're out there,
don't,
I need
go tugging
to,
on
need
Superman's
to know
cape.
So Bill, hopefully that covers that piece. I mean, as far as is 10% for the stock market being sustainable if growth is only 2%, I mean, that is sort of a circumstantial question. I mean, you know, as far as the growth in the market being sustainable, I think Troy can vouch. They've done a lot of research on this since the Depression, 1926, I think, to be exact. But what we're seeing, and actually what we use for planning purposes, is something closer to 10%, because historically that is what we've seen. And so, therefore, I would say it's sustainable even over that same time, having only seen inflation be closer to 2 or 3%. Given that long of a time frame, I think that is sustainable, to answer your question.
Yeah, if you want to boil it down to something a whole lot more simplistic, just assume GDP grows at 2%, plus your 2% inflation gives you 4%, and then if you get 2 or 3% from the dividend, you're real close. I mean, you can already see
right.
that owning stocks gives you the benefit of inflation. You get to participate in that inflation. The earnings are impacted by it. And over the long term, it's definitely going to grow. Your stock price should definitely grow by a rate that's faster than GDP, especially real GDP. Got Ira from Atlanta who says, I wanted to get your opinions on a few holdings I inherited from my late wife's account. W.R. Berkley Corporation, the Clorox Company, and Eli Lilly and Company. So that's kind of a diverse group there. W.R. Berkley is an insurance holding company, so it's going to be in the financial sector. Expected growth 9% in earnings over the next 3 to 5 years. That's usually they try to determine the business cycle. It does meet our criteria for investment based on financial strength and safety. The profitability in this one is a little suspect. I see the EVA spread is negative 1.85, which means that the return on invested capital is not exactly covering the cost of that capital, the weighted average cost of capital. So that's one of the things that I look at pretty closely. 3-year growth in revenue has been about 9%, so that 9% earnings growth looks somewhat reasonable. I would say this one is okay to hold, probably not the best stock that I have seen for a while. It's a property and casualty insurance business. Right now I like the life insurance companies a little better, but I guess it'd be okay to hold. It's one of those that's still a high-quality company. The next one is Clorox, symbol CLX. More or less a one-trick pony. Not a well-diversified consumer staples company, but it is in the consumer staples space. Obviously, very great brand recognition. Should be one of those companies that that you might expect other bigger companies to try to buy out, but there's obviously something going on there. It's been around forever, and it hasn't been bought out. I prefer something a little more diversified. One of the ones that we recommend more often is Unilever. It's got a dividend yield. Unilever does at 3.5%, and it's well covered about 1.5 times by earnings. Better revenue growth at about 2%. So these companies all have, you know, it's they're all kind of well developed. They're in a highly mature space, and they're companies that have been around forever. So when you look at Unilever, the dividend's a little more attractive. Dividend on Clorox is, 2.8%. So, you know, we got about 30% better dividend yield in that case. And I would prefer Unilever, symbol UL. And then Eli Lilly, you asked about, it's a drug manufacturer. It's done okay. Long-term growth is expected at about 10%. EVA spread's positive. This is another one of those we talked about at the first of the show, how healthcare is kind of under fire, especially pharmaceuticals. Company still, you know, meets our investment criteria based on financials. You know, they've had some of their expected success is already priced in. They've got a decent pipeline. I usually hesitate to pronounce the name of these drugs. I'll give this one a try. See why I didn't do it? Solanezumab. It's a Alzheimer's drug. Basically had a failure in a recent FDA test. So it's already impacted negatively the price on Eli Lilly stock. In my estimation, we prefer Johnson & Johnson in the space, which actually, if you think of Johnson & Johnson, they're not only a pharmaceutical, but they make all manner of bandages and
consumer products.
Yeah, they've got loads of it. So it's almost like a staple in the healthcare industry.
Right.
And for that reason, for a long-term holding, I actually would prefer somebody like Johnson & Johnson, you know, they've been able to grow earnings at 4.3%, which is huge for a huge battleship of a company like Johnson & Johnson.
They should be able to you know, weather any kind of downturn if we were to get one.
Yeah, they have a history of that. So, yeah absolutely.
More well-diversified, I guess, than Eli Lilly.
Yeah, and, you know, even if drug profits do get narrowed a bit, you're still going to have the benefit of all those consumer type goods.
Right.
So there you have it. Those three, you know, decent companies, probably not the big growth story that you're going to look for everywhere.
All of those meet our criteria, right? They do. You would call them okay to hold, but there's probably a better use of your money.
Right. Yep. Absolutely, KC. So we got another question here. Patrick from Alpharetta says, my parents are getting up in years. My dad just named me as beneficiary of his IRA. I'm not expecting him to die soon. Well, that's good. But if he does, what do I need to know about the IRA?
Yeah, a few things to know here. We'll try to get it all in the rest of this segment there, Patrick. But I think primarily, you know, knowing that since you're saying this is coming from your dad and it's not a spouse, which could be treated differently, but you will be essentially inheriting the IRA, and that is going to cause you to have an inherited IRA, which will also cause you to start having to take required minimum distributions from that account. If it were coming from your spouse, you may be able to defer that inheritance until you're age 70 and a half, which is typically when you have to start taking required minimum distributions. But since this is coming from your dad, those required minimum distributions will begin in that year following his death. So generally, you know, you're going to have to start taking that based on your life expectancy. I'd say that's probably a major consideration for you to make. There's some others here. I don't know, Casey, if there's something that sticks out to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing is the difference between a spousal IRA, inherited IRA, and a non-spousal inherited IRA, which you've hit on pretty well there, Jarrett. You know, spouse has a lot more options. As a non-spouse, we would go into an IRA, but the benefit is it goes into an IRA in your name as the non-spouse beneficiary. So you are able to take those required minimum distributions over your life expectancy, not your father. So it stretches out the IRA and the ability of you to allow those tax-deferred assets to continue to remain tax-deferred.
Yeah, so and keep in mind, if that's a large IRA, Patrick, that's, you know, that could potentially affect your taxable income, because that those distributions, those required distributions, will be taxed at your ordinary income rate.
Yeah.
So it's something to keep in mind, and while we say that's a primary consideration, but ultimately also, you know, that account is going to surpass your father's estate. I mean, if you are the primary beneficiary, then that's going to come straight to you. You don't have to wait for those assets to go through probate. That's something big. But also, you know, if you've got any siblings that he is also leaving it to as a primary beneficiary, then, you know, they're going to be in much the same boat as you, but that account would have to be distributed to them as well. But those are, I think, the biggest considerations to be made. I mean, the required minimum distributions is always going to be the most impactful, I think.
Yeah, I mean, another thing just to keep in mind, I mean, an IRA, you do get some benefits. The tax deferral we've kind of hit on already. You more than likely have an IRA or a 401k, Patrick, and if you do, then you are probably familiar with some of this, but you do get some creditor protection inside of that IRA wrapper as well, so your father's IRA would be treated the same way. You would have that creditor protection, go back here. So a normal IRA, you would, but in this case, because it's an inherited IRA, then you may not get that same creditor protection that you would from a normal IRA or 401k.
Even in bankruptcy, I mean, if God forbid you had to consider filing bankruptcy, that is something that, you know, you would want to consider. You probably aren't doing that. But just so you know, I mean, that is something, like Casey was saying, that in traditional and normal Roth IRAs, you're going to have some of that protection, whereas inherited assets typically are not going to. So if you ever get presented in that kind of situation, just be prepared to fight that battle.
All right, Patrick, hope that helps you. Guys, toward the end of the show, one question left to ask. Market going to be up or down this week, Jarrett?
Man, after we've seen 12 record highs since the election, I cannot imagine or even fathom sitting here saying it'll be down, so I'm going with up.
Casey, I got to go up, too.
Yeah, I'm still the broken record. I see the market goes up. You guys have a great week.
All material presented is compiled from sources believed to be reliable and current, but accuracy cannot be guaranteed. The contents are intended for general information purposes only. Information provided should not be the sole basis in making any decisions and is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified professional, such as a tax consultant, insurance advisor, or attorney. Although this material is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with respect to the subject matter, it may not apply in all situations. This is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell any financial instruments. It is not our intention to state, indicate, or imply in any manner that current or past results are indicative of future profitability or expectations. Portfolio holdings discussed are subject to change. There is no guarantee that in the future these securities will be held in Hensler accounts. As with all investments, there are associated inherent risks. Please obtain and review all financial material carefully before investing. Hensler is not licensed to offer or sell insurance products. This overview is not to be construed as an offer to purchase any insurance products.